I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 26th of September. All things political this hour. And it's the afternoon, of course, before the big debate. 100 million people may watch. That's a lot of people. Yesterday, the New York Times endorsed Hillary Clinton for president and said the editorial believes Mr. Trump to be the worst nominee put forward by a major party in modern American history. Does our guest agree with that? And today, the Washington Post editorial board wrote, Mr. Trump has amply demonstrated his unworthiness to occupy the Oval Office. It's beyond his capacity in the upcoming 90-minute question and answer sessions to reverse or even substantially modify that conclusion. But the race has become much closer in the last week. As David Axelrod writes, what elite commentators have dismissed as boorishness has to many alienated voters signified strength, authenticity, and crucially, a willingness to defy political correctness. Will he ride the horse that got him here tonight or turn in a muted performance? Which should he turn in? The U.S. Supreme Court will soon be considering whether to hear an appeal of the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling that halted the John Doe investigation and directed destruction of evidence. The Guardian recently published a very lengthy piece on all of this. We'll talk about it with our guest. And Charlotte explodes over the weekend after a police shooting of an African-American male. The video is sort of sketchy here. You can't determine whether or not he had a gun in his hand. There was another shooting in Tulsa. Results there in the officer being charged with manslaughter. So we'll talk about cities erupting this hour as well. And our guest is Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine. She's a native of Madison, began her career as a political writer working with Irwin Knoll, and has covered progressive politics ever since, including elections, welfare reform, the war on drugs, feminism, and public education. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we'll have many of them as we anticipate tonight's debate. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Ruth, hello. Thanks very much for being with us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll have a rip-roaring good time today. Mr. Trump, the New York editorial board writes yesterday, is the worst nominee put forward by a major party in modern American history. Do you agree?
Yes, I do. I do. I mean, my husband and I were talking to our kids about it and trying to explain to them why this presidential election is different from other elections. It's just sort of astounding. And I think even Republicans feel that way about Trump. They felt that way for the whole primary season. Now we're moving into the first debate of the general election, and it's still this kind of rubbernecking event where people are kind of astounded and waiting to see what he does. And I think a large reason that we have such a huge audience tonight is that people are wondering if something really, you know, a new low in American politics is about to occur, and they'll see it live.
Yeah. Do you think it's true? I read this number that 15 to 20% of the American public is undecided. How could the figure be that large at this point? Do you think that number is true? And how important, I wonder if they'll be watching the debate tonight. I would imagine some will. So there's still a crucial audience that Trump and Clinton can try to persuade.
Well, I think people who are undecided, there are a variety of people in that group. And every presidential election, it seems bizarre. And there is a lot of late-night comedy, actually, that comes out of this idea that people can't decide between two candidates who appear to occupy opposite poles of American politics. Like, who is that? Who is that person who's really still confused at this late date? But I don't think that's the 15%. I think, actually, there are a lot of people in that number who are either Republicans trying to decide whether to show party loyalty and vote for Trump despite really his being very much disliked by a large part of the Republican establishment. And there are people who were Bernie Sanders supporters who are trying to decide whether they're going to come around to vote for Hillary Clinton after a bruising primary campaign in which Sanders made a really strong case against Clinton. So I think the undecided voters include not just the truly uninformed or sort of, you know, random deciders, but also people who are torn because these are unpopular candidates.
Mm-hmm. I keep thinking about the millennial voters and reading the Pew research over the weekend. That I was amazed by this, Ruth. There are more 24-year-olds than any other age right now in this country. I would have thought it was older than that, but 24-year-olds. And that generation has been fairly progressive, quite liberal. Will they really be important in this election? Does Hillary Clinton need those voters? And do you think they plan to vote for her?
I think that they're really important, and I think they're important to the future of the country, not just to, you know, the fate of Hillary Clinton's candidacy. And I think that something very different is happening this year, which is that we have a generation that grew up post-Cold War, largely post-9/11, and who have really been thinking about what are their prospects for the future in an age of enormously burdensome college debt and a scary economic picture. So that's a very different political reality than the 1990s. And I think Trump is talking to a lot of those people when he talks about how American workers have been left behind. And I think the two major parties have not adequately grappled with this. Mm-hmm. So on the one side, you have the Republican Party falling apart and Donald Trump, for the first time, have a Republican candidate who really opposes the kind of trade deals that have been very much embraced by the Republican Party and a message that's very anti-establishment. And on the Democratic side, you had this really tough primary race where there was a Bernie Sanders contingent that said, you know, this politics is not working. And so I think that group of folks is going to have a lot to say in this election. I do think they'll vote. I don't know. I think their vote will be somewhat divided. And I think one of the big tests for Hillary Clinton tonight is to make the case that she really is hearing and listening to that generation of voters and that they really should not just hold their nose and vote for her, but actively come out and say, yeah, we've got to make this decision.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how many are contemplating, particularly Gary Johnson right now.
Right. Gary Johnson, you hear about a lot more than Jill Stein,
yes,
the Green Party candidate. And I think there is a significant PLF vote for the Libertarian Party candidate. Of course, Bill Leaders, our associate editor, wrote a great piece on our website about, do these folks even know what Gary Johnson and the Libertarian Party really stand for? Because it's not exactly an antidote, to the brazen corporatism of American politics, which is what a lot of millennials are objecting to. So I think that will have some... I think there'll be some peel off for Gary Johnson, some peel off for Jill Stein. But so far, the polls don't show that that's a huge percentage of voters.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the polls, as long as you brought them up. This race, if we're to believe the polls this year, who knows with polls anymore, but it really is tightening. So most pollsters will say now, we got pretty much, a dead even race right now. How did that happen?
I know. it's not a pretty picture when you contemplate the possibility that we could have a Donald Trump presidency. It actually could happen. And I feel like the general electorate is in the same place that the Republican Party was during the primaries, which is thinking, no, it can't happen. He can't do it. And yet, we're watching this unfold now in the general election the same way we did in the Republican primaries. It's going to be all about turnout.
Mm-hmm. And so what is Hillary Clinton's problem?
Well, I think that Hillary Clinton has had the same problem throughout the primaries and the general election, which is that some of it is sexism, actually. I think in many ways she's not very different from other mainstream Democratic politicians who are more popular, like Barack Obama, like Joe Biden, because I think that culturally, with the first woman major party candidate, I think the country has yet to adjust to the idea of a powerful and charismatic and qualified female candidate. So she gets dinged for things like being in the pocket of Wall Street and, making a lot of money in a way that Joe Biden, who could easily be criticized for the same things, or Barack Obama, who got more Wall Street support than any presidential mm-hmm. candidate in history could be, but somehow it sticks to her more. And then I think that her personal style, as she herself has acknowledged, is sort of wonky and unexciting. And then I think she's just out of step with the mood of younger voters and the country, which is to say that both major parties have simply not been addressing the needs of working people. And we have this decades-long decline of our middle class, and that's people's most urgent worry. And you know, she has a lot of baggage from the 1990s and the two terms of her husband's presidency, in which, you know, that grew. We deregulated the banks and we, you know, we increased income inequality and set ourselves on a path to where we are now. So that's a lot to overcome.
Mm-hmm. And she does, they both do, have a lot to explain. And I can see how it wouldn't be very attractive to younger people and to many people who are economically hurting right now. The Clintons have made a heck of a lot of money, and they have made it under, you know, a lot of money from Goldman Sachs, a lot of money from all kinds of places. I mean, tens of millions of dollars, and it's as though, give me more, give me more. It just runs counter in many ways to what many people are saying. Listen, I'm hurting right now. Do something to help us.
I know, but it's funny, isn't it, how being wealthy is an asset for Donald Trump and a liability for Hillary Clinton. I mean, why is it greedy for Hillary Clinton to make a lot of money giving speeches, which she should have released, and which I think Bernie Sanders rightly pointed out, you know, not for nothing do banks give millions of dollars to a candidate. She represented New York. So that was a lot of Wall Street money involved in her Senate career. But at the same time, you know, here you have Donald Trump running this empire of dodgy salesmanship of his brand, you know, all kinds of strange companies. And yet somehow his wealth is part of this vision of American success. He's able to leverage that. So I think there's a bit of a double standard there.
Mm-hmm. Although it is nice to have a vision of somebody running the country who is indeed a true public servant and is serving because he or she wants to really work on the good of the American public instead of, you know, and it's not just the two of them. You got the Senate filled with millionaires and a lot of people in the House filled with millionaires. It seems as though that's part of the game right now. You can't play unless you got a ton of dough.
Well, there's personal wealth, and there is, you know, and Hillary Clinton's worth $20 million. She's got substantial personal wealth, not on the Trump scale, but then there's campaign money, and that's really the corrupting influence of money in politics is very visible to people now, and the degree to which candidates fundraise and then carry water for the interests they fundraise from is a top concern. And I think that Hillary Clinton has not adequately argued that. I mean, she's tried to dismiss it and said it wasn't really a very big deal. And I think that didn't go over well with a lot of people. Trump, on the other hand, says he's, you know, nobody's president but yours. He's so rich that he's, you know, he sort of brags about his own playing in politics and the fact that he paid Hillary Clinton, for example, to come to his wedding, you know, that they do what you want when you give them money. And see, he sees how that works, and he's so wealthy that he won't be bought, which is sort of a dubious argument.
Right.
But they're talking about this stuff because the public cares.
Yeah, and then doesn't pay the people who do work for him because he didn't like the work that was done, so you don't pay people who work for you, even though you're trying to address those people who aren't doing very well in this economy.
That should be a concern to voters, I think.
This thing is crazy, isn't it? A lot of people have been talking about who brings what to the stage tonight. Does it behoove Hillary Clinton to bring that wonky personality, or do we need somebody who really is cutting to the quick with Donald Trump and calling him on the many things he has said that are not true and on who he is? Does it behoove a Donald Trump? People are watching to see how outrageous he's going to be. That's why the numbers are going to be so high. Does it behoove him to present, you know, calm, collected, reasonable Donald Trump to reach those 15 to 20% who are undecided, or some Republicans who think he's too scary to be president? Who is best brought to the podium tonight on both sides?
Well, on Trump's side, I think for sure the people who want him to win the election would like him to present himself as presidential, as calm, and not to do anything crazy. And they've actually sort of set, his advisors have sort of set the bar low in suggesting that that would be a win for him. The problem is their candidate doesn't really listen to them very well. And I think he may not be able to resist it. He talks incessantly about his poll numbers and his ratings. And in fact, he probably will drive giant ratings for the debate tonight. So I think he may or may not be able to control himself. And on the other side, Hillary Clinton's team seems to have indicated that she may try to needle him a little bit. He has shown that he loses it a little bit with women in particular who point out his misogyny or confront him face to face, as Megyn Kelly did, as Carly Fiorina did. And he looked awkward and uncomfortable when he was confronted with his own really outrageous statements. So she may try to do a little bit of that. And I think it would probably behoove her to do a little bit, but not too much, to not get sucked into that insult fest that we saw in the Republican primary debates, and to be herself and to show that she has a very impressive command of the issues, which she does.
And that will be a fascinating part of the debate, because he really doesn't have an impressive knowledge of a lot of the issues. He just doesn't. He doesn't concentrate on that. And she, if anybody, she really does. So to see the two of them trying to talk about these important issues, that's why I'm tuning in. I want to see what they're going to say about it.
It'll be the first time that he has to do a one-on-one debate, and he'll have a lot of airtime. And I think it'll be harder for him to make a couple of provocative statements and then sit back and wait for the details to go by. So, you know, I think that's right. It's a big challenge for him, and he's going to bet that his skill on television and as an entertainer will carry him. And it'll be interesting to see whether that's true in this long format.
Yeah. I want to give you another issue, and then we're going to go to phone calls so the audience can go whatever way they'd like. But the U.S. Supreme Court is soon going to be considering whether to hear the appeal of the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling that halted the John Doe investigation and directed destruction of evidence. The Guardian recently ran a long piece on big money donations and how they were made to skirt Wisconsin campaign laws. Do you have any inkling of where the Supreme Court may go on this?
I don't. I think it's really, I don't know if they will choose it or not. And I think certainly the New Yorker made a very compelling argument that they should in the most recent article on the Doe that I saw. But I think the issue of money in politics, which we were just talking about, is really at the top of people's minds. And here in Wisconsin, when you look at that Guardian story and how it's laid out, you see that Governor Walker went on this fundraising spree and directly asked people to contribute to Club for Growth in order to finance his campaign in the recall and the campaigns of Wisconsin's state senators in the recall. So there's no doubt but that he was fundraising. It would have been illegal from the people he was fundraising from to give directly to him because of campaign finance limits. And so he was completely flouting the idea that organizations like Club for Growth and other, you know, under Citizens United, these 527 organizations that can raise money for issue advocacy and candidates ought to operate separately. There's no doubt that there was coordination going on. But more than that, the level of corruption, the fact that it extends to our state Supreme Court, the fact that justices whose campaigns got money from Club for Growth themselves did not recuse themselves in this case, and then ordered evidence destroyed that included evidence of their benefiting from this same group. It's real. It stinks to the sky. And it goes to the heart of what's wrong with money in politics and its corrupting influence, not to mention the lead paint manufacturer who, you know, gives a lot of money and then Wisconsin children who are lead poisoned can't sue anymore thanks to action on his behalf by Republicans in our state legislature and Walker himself. You know, I mean, this is so clearly contrary to the public interest. It is so clearly corrupt. I think the fact that it's all laid out and that, you know, we got to see these documents instead of having them destroyed and not see the light of day is really important to citizens to just grapple with this problem, whatever happens at the Supreme Court level.
Well, let's go to phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. Ruth Conniff is our guest. And we're talking all things political this hour of the program. Big debate tonight. You can talk about that. And it is a big story what The Guardian published in whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court should take the appeal of the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling halting the John Doe investigation and directing destruction of evidence, which didn't completely happen because The Guardian got some of the evidence, right? So do you think the Supreme Court should take this? But what are you looking for tonight? Who should appear on stage? You know, this is a time for you to rally around your candidate, too, and explain why. That's fine. We'd like to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Our guest is Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Progressive Magazine. To you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, and we start with Hattie in northern Minnesota. Hi, Hattie.
Hi. I just want to talk about the value of the debates in general. I am a Bernie supporter who now is voting for Hillary Clinton. And like you were indicating earlier, I can't imagine why anybody would be undecided at this point. But my problem with the debates is that no one fact-checked while they're talking. And it's all about who can get the biggest clip in or who can make the most memorable line or what have you. For example, last year, or the last election, I should say, the debate between Romney and Obama, after the debate, they said Romney won. And in the debate, Romney told lie after lie after lie, but he presented himself better. And I don't think that's very valuable. I used to coach debate and contest speech, and so I know a little bit about it. And it's nothing like that. If there's no fact checking, to me, there's no value to the debate. And I guess I would indicate too that people need to pay attention not just to the debate, but to what the candidates have been saying all along.
Mm-hmm.
And I supported Bernie financially and otherwise for months because he talked about the issue that I cared about. But I can't go, you know, to someone as out of the ordinary as Donald Trump and vote for him with clear conscience. And so I am now financially and otherwise backing Hillary. She's the best choice.
Thanks, Hattie, for the call. What do you do about fact-checking? Because Donald Trump has been known. The Times yesterday published a huge long list of facts that were erroneous that he's told just in a few days period of time.
Yeah, I mean, fact-checking Donald Trump is going to be a scramble because there's going to be a lot of need for it. This has been its own separate debate in the lead-up to tonight. So Lester Holt, the debate moderator, is, you know, under some significant pressure not to look the way Matt Lauer looked when he moderated the candidate forum and failed spectacularly to fact-check Donald Trump, most notably on Trump's claim that he had opposed the Iraq War, which he did not. So There was a lot of criticism, certainly among journalists, a great deal of criticism of Lauer. And the idea that, you know, Chris Wallace, who's moderating the last debate for Fox, has said he's not going to fact check. He doesn't see his role as the truth squad. But that's really an abdication of responsibility as a journalist. And I think particularly given how much of a free pass the media has given to Donald Trump and how much the willingness to give him an enormous amount of coverage starting very early on has fed the Trump campaign to the chagrin of a lot of editors and you know, media folks, is really a lesson. And I think it shows that if there's any self-respect in the profession of journalism, you know, now in these closing days of the general election, it's really up to journalists to fact-check Donald Trump and not to just treat this as an open forum. He said, she said, who knows what the truth is. There is such a thing as the truth.
Thanks, Hattie, for your call. Joanne in West Dallas, hi.
Hi, Kathleen and Ruth. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask or comment, I guess, I had always thought that in the United States, a person is innocent until proven guilty, unless you're Hillary Clinton, and then you're guilty, and even after you're proven innocent, you're still guilty. And, you know, with all of the investigations, Ken Starr, and millions of dollars and months of time spent on it, I'll tell you, I've only had a couple speeding tickets in my life, but I don't think I could stand that kind of scrutiny in the headlines every day. And I'd like to know, you know, what are the scandals that are so terrible that she's accused of, because they never found anything.
Well, I mean, you know them, and a lot of people know them. There's a whole parallel universe in which, you know, Hillary Clinton, I mean, I was at the Republican convention listening to the delegates there chant, lock her up, lock her up.
Yes.
You know, the idea that there's criminality and even murder in Hillary Clinton's background is really kind of an artifact of right-wing media. And it grew up around Bill Clinton, you know, during the 90s, that the power of that right-wing media that was really built on a great hatred. The American Spectator became a huge circulation magazine, mostly on the strength of all these Clinton investigations and conspiracy theories. And then that morphed into Fox News. And so it's, you know, it's a powerful force in the country, and Trump is tapping directly into it. I mean, you remember now, he was a promoter of the idea that President Obama was not born in the United States, carried that right up until the last couple of weeks. He never renounced this idea, which was so clearly false. And then he tried to pin it on Hillary Clinton. So, you know, that stuff is alive, and it's going to have an impact on the election. But it's a very distorted glass that people are seeing Hillary Clinton through.
Mm-hmm. Well, she did face, you know, the FBI report about how she handled the email was not very laudatory. She was extremely careless with what she did. There's grounds there for criticism of her and
how
she handled health care, too. She's been very secretive, and that leads into, you know, secrecy is not the best. It's best to have more transparency if you're running for president, right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, it was interesting, though, when James Comey issued his very scolding report on Hillary Clinton's email server and said that it was careless. Instead of really making hay out of that, the Trump campaign attacked him for not going far enough, which I think, I think that shows the division between truth and this parallel universe, that certainly Hillary Clinton has done some things that are, if there's no content there, for example, with her health, the impulse to keep that information private, to not release information for a couple of days, feeds these conspiracy theories. And it's kind of a vicious cycle, because I think her experience has been that there's no percentage in revealing anything. And so, you know, she continues to keep things very quiet. She has this very tight group of advisors who keep their mouths shut. And yet that feeds the suspicion. So that's definitely that's a cloud that follows her around and has for a long time.
Joanne, thanks for your call. We go to Scott in Green Bay next. Hi, Scott.
Good afternoon. I'm one of those people that I actually can't watch the debate just because I don't have anybody that I could possibly vote for that's going to be on stage, and I'm not sure how many other people are going to be in the same position as I am. I mean, you've got Trump, who's a disaster, and you've got Hillary. I'm sorry, I'm going to add a little balance here. It's the most contrived candidate I've ever seen in my life. I mean, Trump lies outwardly, but she is so focus poll driven that there's no authenticity, which I find to be a massive lie in itself.
All right, Scott, I'm going to hold you there. Your phone is lousy, but we got what you were going to say. Ruth, go ahead.
Well, right, authenticity, that is definitely that's definitely a quality that people see in Donald Trump, although not the caller, apparently, and see lacking in Hillary Clinton. But I kind of think we're, you know, beyond that phase of the campaign. I mean, I suppose to the extent that it's not so much about personality, and I do think that's part of it with Hillary Clinton. She's very practiced, and that really comes across as inauthentic. And some of that, I think, is not substantive, really. But to the extent that she changes her positions, I think voters have a hard time feeling confident that she's got these core values that she's going to stick to. And I think that's one of the things that she needs to do tonight, is really make the case that, in fact, you know, she's been an advocate for women and children all her life. That's going to continue. That she's a much more credible candidate for protecting African Americans, and just the convulsion over police violence against African Americans, that she's the candidate who's going to deal with that, who cares about social justice. But I think there's a case that she can make. And I think there's issues like trade, where she has clearly taken completely opposite positions in a pretty short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, because it's certainly been conversation in many of the people I've been speaking with, friends of mine, over the last week or so. What do you think a Donald Trump presidency would mean for the future of America, Ruth? And what do you think Hillary Clinton presidency would mean for the future of America?
I mean, I think a Hillary Clinton presidency is a status quo vote. You know, I think it's a vote for really continuing the policies of the Obama administration, which, after all, I think staved off a Great Depression in this country, but also fed inequality, enhanced corporate power, pursued extra legal killings and torture by proxy around the globe. I mean, there's a really serious critique of the Obama administration that people can make. And I think it's fair to say that Hillary Clinton would continue for better and for worse, most of those policies. On the Trump side, God only knows. You know, I mean, he's talked about rounding people up and putting them in camps. I mean, I think it's really something to imagine a president of the United States who talks about Putin's poll numbers and admires him as a strong leader, and who really seems to feel totally confident that he doesn't need any preparation to be president of the United States. And the explicit bigotry in his campaign, which is really alarming, I think, should frighten all of us, and particularly members of the groups that he's directed that hatefulness at. I mean, this next president will appoint at least one justice to the United States Supreme Court, and Trump has said that a federal judge should be disqualified because of his Mexican-American heritage. I mean, that's a whole new frontier in American politics, and it's frightening.
Jim in Rice Lake, hi.
Hi, it's Kathleen. Your guest commented on the Wisconsin Supreme Court's failure to recuse themselves, many of the justices, and the case involving the John Doe investigation when Club for Growth was the subject of the investigation, and the justices, many of them had received tens of thousands of dollars from them. I just want to let you know that I'm a trial court attorney, and it's an open joke within the Wisconsin court system, conservatives as well as liberals, that Wisconsin has the best Supreme Court that money can buy. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Jim, for your call.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that phrase, and I think, you know, one place where it started was Michael Gableman on the state Supreme Court. Newsweek covered that race and how dirty it was, how heavily influenced by outside money it was, the Willie Horton-style campaign that he ran, and the fact that he was the most overturned judge in the appeals court system in the state and yet made it to the bench with a big boost from Club for Growth. I mean, it's really worth looking at our state Supreme Court and what's happened to it. It's not just Scott Walker. It's not just the Republican legislature, but it's that court that's really distorted our politics.
David in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Am I on? David in Madison?
David in Madison. You're on. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Sure.
A couple notes about Mr. Trump and the Republicans. Think of as the Brewers conclude another uneventful season. People like to root for the home team. And in baseball recently, there's been a couple of players, one for the Mets, one for the Cubs, who were, serving suspensions for domestic abuse and things like that. But now their fans are cheering them on. I'm not suggesting there's any abuse by Mr. Trump, but the analogy is that even somebody with a less than stellar or even spotty record, once you get on a certain team, people who identify with that team are going to root for that person. And I think that's why the poll numbers are close. We've got a very close electorate nationally overall on the people who identify as Republicans or Democrats. So, I think most Republicans are going to, quote, come home and root for and vote for Trump. I think that's why it's so close. So I don't think that's a failing of Hillary Clinton, but more an identification by many people with the big red R, which is fine, the way the game is played these days. The fact that a lot of leading Republican former generals, members of the Bush family, et cetera, are opposed to Trump. I don't take, there's not much there for Hillary Clinton. It's like a few baseball general managers who passed on these spotty players. Some of the elite are going to say, oh, we don't like Trump, Republican elite. But the mass of people who identify as Republicans are going to vote. And the other thing is a lot of family and friends who are evangelicals, they're wonderful people. I love them dearly, many of my good friends and family. In that context, and I grew out of it myself, there's a strong male figure kind of running the show, is that the traditional version of a God figure, who in the end analysis, no matter how nice you are to the other folks who don't quite see the light, the big male strong figure in the end kind of separates the sheep from the goats. And I think Mr. Trump kind of fits that loose theological analogy in that, there's the good versus the bad people. Let's divide him up at the end here. And, we know who Trump would say would be the goats. And I think that appeals to the people who evangelicals. So the idea that they evangelicals wouldn't come home to Trump, I think, was nonsense all along, because he does fit that,
David,
that strong daddy like Ronald Reagan.
David, do you think he's going to win?
Do I think he's going to win?
Yes.
I really think it's going to be extremely close in Electoral College, and I think the real problem for Clinton is going to be North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Florida, where the voter ID have maybe going to suppress 1 or 2%, and they could flip a number of states closely. For Trump, I think Trump has a chance to win because of, you know, everything else given, and then I think that could be the tell there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, David, for your call. Ruth?
Yeah, I mean, I think the caller is right that it comes down to swing states and that they're very close. And then I think that sort of basic framework, I mean, this is the George Lakoff analysis, that you have conservative and liberal kind of structures of thinking, and the conservative structure of thinking is the authoritarian father figure. It's sort of central to how you view the world. But I talked to a lot of Cruz delegates at the Republican convention. Of course, Cruz is now backing Trump, which is sort of the last big tree to fall, because he made such a strong and he argued principled stand against Trump at the convention, which was extremely controversial at the time. But a lot of those delegates were really unhappy with Trump and really don't see him as representing their values. So I'm not sure that the Republican Party falling into line is what's propelling Trump or his poll numbers. I think it's something else, which is this kind of crack up. It's the sense in the country that we don't have the deal that we used to talk about as the American dream, and that large numbers of people, and particularly in the industrial Midwest and the swing states, who had good union jobs and sent their kids to college and saw upward mobility as a given in their lives, are looking at a very different picture now. And that those jobs have fled, that people's incomes have slid, and there's a tremendous amount of anxiety. And Trump represents the right-wing populist vision that's arising in those economically anxious times. He's the first major party candidate with very explicit white supremacist support. Mm-hmm. And it's a, you know, it's a kind of a Germany 1930s kind of a feel to his campaign. And it's, you know, on the sunnier side, we had the Bernie Sanders campaign that spoke to people's anxieties and talked about a possible progressive future. And on the Trump side, we have scapegoating of immigrants and Muslims and people of color. And, it's the right wing vision of, you know, the right wing response to that populist unrest. So that's a different thing from just the Republican establishment falling in line. Mm-hmm. That's a different frontier in politics. And it's going to be that way for a long time. I think we're looking at a different kind of political reality in this country now.
Let's center on North Carolina a little bit more. North Carolina really under scrutiny by a lot of businesses, sports franchises. We're not having our championship event because of LGBT discrimination. And now with that happening, we have what's been going on in Charlotte after the police killing of the African-American over the weekend, or Friday, I think it took place, and the subsequent demonstrations and eruptions of great discontent that have been taking place in a city that has been known for a little bit of racial harmony. I was listening to some Republican analyst who I think is very good, who said that all of this, because Trump is the law and order candidate, really plays into his hands, that there are a lot of people who don't like that. They don't like that we're becoming a majority population. They don't like the fact that the president is actually born in America and has been president for 8 years. There's a big element of that going on. And his belief was that because of all of this, Donald Trump will win North Carolina. Would you agree with that?
Well, I can't say that I'm sure that Donald Trump will win North Carolina. And actually, that's a place where voter ID has been overturned. So that's a significant factor. Mm-hmm. The voter ID law there, like Wisconsin, is going to have a big impact on whether black voters are going to be able to go to the polls and vote. But, you know, there are two parallel things happening. There is that backlash. There is that law and order sort of Nixon 1960s feeling among many white voters who like Donald Trump. But there's also a movement in this country that has really been amazing to watch. And we've been covering it at The Progressive. Our writer, Kevin Alexander Gray, who's a Panthers fan, actually, and was debating whether or not to go to the football game in Charlotte on Sunday, saying he wouldn't cross a line of black citizens who were blocking the stadium if that's what happened. Hmm. He's written, and Dave Zirin, our sports columnist, has written a lot about Colin Kaepernick and this, you know, taking a knee for the national anthem, which has spread now from the National Football League to the NBA and to, you know, the East versus West homecoming game here in Madison on Friday night.
Really?
You know, all across the country, young people inspired by Kaepernick are taking part in this demonstration. And there is really, I think, a tremendous amount of grassroots energy around just the raw injustice of the videos that we've seen of police shootings of African-American citizens. And this is something that will come up tonight because Lester Holt, an African-American moderator, is going to talk about it with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And we will see the two poles of reaction to these events. And I am not convinced that the United States is a country that is moving backwards towards police violence to contain an African-American population, and particularly in instances where clearly the people who are being shot by police were doing nothing to provoke that. I think that the conscience of the nation has also been aroused, and I think that'll be a factor in the debate tonight and in the election.
Ruth Conniff is our guest, and it's All Things Political you're listening to. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. Ruth is editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Marty, our next caller in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. God, Ruth, I just love listening to you. I really do. I do have a question, but I've been wondering if Hillary Clinton has been reminded these last few weeks, as I have, of a skit that Saturday Night Live did in 1980 where actors playing Bush Sr. and Dukakis were debating, and the Bush character was just going on and on, just rambling on this vapid verbal journey to nowhere. And the actor playing Dukakis just turned to the camera and said, "I can't believe I'm losing to this guy." oh, my God. But anyway, Ruth, do you have any insight into the reason why anyone who supported Bernie Sanders, I've heard people say this, who are now no longer supporting Sanders, they're supporting Trump. And the only reason I can think of is that they just don't want to see a woman be president. What other possible conceivable reason could someone who thought Sanders would be great now would think that Trump is?
Well, there is sexism, without a doubt. That is a strong current in the country. But I think also Trump and Sanders were both campaigning and speaking to people who feel like they've been had, and that whether it's Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton or George W. Bush, that the major party candidates and presidents of the United States don't actually care about ordinary people, and that we're pretending to be a wealthy country when we're a country of extreme wealth for a very few and a huge subterranean struggle by working class people who, you know, their struggle's not even getting much attention in politics. So I do think that that's a similarity between Trump's message and Sanders's message. It's just that their solution in Sanders' case is to go after the banks and the very wealthy. And in Trump's case, it's to go after Mexican immigrants and Muslims who ultimately can't do very much, you know, either way, you know. But so I think the solutions are different, but the discontent that both of those candidates captured is alive out there, and it's some of the same people who are having those feelings, the Trump supporters and the Sanders supporters.
Thanks, Marty, so much for your call. Yeah, Emil in Milwaukee, hi.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. I had a couple of points to make. First, I have to say, as someone who was born in Nigeria, lived around the world, and I always admired the American democratic system, at least when I was an outsider looking in. It's kind of surprising to see how much lack of discourse there is. And I think it has a lot to do as to how we've gotten here. People don't talk about politics at the bar. It's a no-go area. And the problem with not exchanging ideas is you end up with two of the most unlikely candidates ever in history running for president. Because, you know, there are no exchange of ideas and people aren't talking about things. That's just not cool. The second point I had is something Obama actually touched on one of these days. The problem with Trump is it kind of signifies a failure of some sort of our democracy in a way. Think about you expect parties, the two major parties, to present two of the strongest candidates who, at a very base level, have some basic qualifications. For instance, if Obama had lost to McCain, I don't think the world would have ended. If Mitt Romney had won, no one would have gotten feeling, oh, yeah, our new president doesn't just have this base level of competence. And when you look at it from that standpoint, you don't hire a plumber to do the job of a carpenter. You hire a carpenter, and that's what we have. We have Trump versus Hillary Clinton. One person at least has the base competence to do the job. The next person just doesn't. And it makes you wonder how we got here. And on that threshold question, as to competence, I'm amazed that it's even up for debate, regardless of how you feel about Hillary Clinton. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Emil.
Yeah, I don't know that the Trump campaign makes much effort to defend his competence. I think he's doing something completely different from what other candidates have done, which is he's running his campaign as a reality television show, and he's good at that. And so one thing that's interesting about tonight is going to be seeing how that carries in a one-on-one debate for 90 minutes. That's a very different format than he's used to.
And let's talk about, Bob Kerry made mention of this in something that he wrote over the weekend, too, looking at a lot of American voters who he said are massively uninformed. We've been talking about that 15 to 20% going to make their decision based on a debate tonight. Are you serious? After these people have been all over the place for how long now? That we are. I think there's some truth in that. I mean, how can a huge number of people believe that our president was born in Kenya, something that Donald Trump floated, you know, long, long time ago? You have to be massively uninformed to believe things like that. I don't get that, Ruth. Where is that coming from?
Well, I think there was a study, Fairness and Accuracy Reporting, when it was around, run by Jeff Cohen, did a study during the Gulf War, and it turned out that the more TV news people watched, the less they knew about the basics of the Gulf War. And, you know, we've seen Trump be pretty successful with these completely counterfactual statements, you know, whether it's watching thousands of people cheer in Jersey City right when the World Trade Center fell, which didn't happen, to saying he was against the war in Iraq, which he was not, and was on record supporting it. So, you know, I think that it's always been the case that there's a certain amount of lying and obfuscation in politics, but maybe the entertainmentization of news and the way that people are siloed into their sort of ideologically compatible silos now has made it much harder to get any sort of accepted standard of facts out there. And that's another reason why it's so important tonight that Lester Holt actually play that role of being the arbiter of fact.
Gary in Merrill, hi.
Yes, hello. I suppose because of the debate tonight, there's been the blackout of the Turkish-born Muslim terrorist that shot and killed four women and a man at the mall in Washington State. However, according to Frontline over the years, we learned that George Bush and Dick Cheney attacked Libya and Iraq and Afghanistan unprovoked, and then comes Obama and Hillary as Secretary of State, and they take on Egypt and Libya. They made sure he was murdered, and now in Syria, they're destroying the Middle East for this globalism, for their corporatocracy, and Hillary should be waiting to be tried for crimes against humanity instead of running for president.
Ruth.
Well, there is no doubt that the United States has made a hash out of country after country in the Middle East, and that that has directly given rise to ISIS and the very insecure and frightening situation, particularly for people there, for Syrian refugees, for people who've lived through the war in Iraq. You know, it's a huge problem, and I think it's true that that's not going to be given a close examination tonight. I think that, you know, you have bellicose and more bellicose on the ballot. And that's, you know, we just saw Medea Benjamin in the Progressive Magazine's office. She came through town promoting her new book on Saudi Arabia and the way that the United States has really bolstered terrorism and the weapons trade around the world and upheld the Saudi regime, which, you know, fosters both. And that, you know, we need to have a much more serious discussion about destructive U.S. foreign policy and how we have a humane and just foreign policy and stop this endless war. I think the caller has a really important point to make about that.
30 seconds we have left. Tony in Milwaukee, quickly, please. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, Tony, go ahead.
Yeah, the problem is that the Fourth Estate has just stepped aside. and let people like Scott Walker get into office, and let Donald Trump have a successful campaign. The Fourth Estate has not allowed, not gone after these people and fact-checking them, which they're supposed to do. That's the job of the Fourth Estate. And I just want you to comment on that, and I'll hear it off.
Thanks, Tony. And quickly, Ruth.
I think that's absolutely right. And you see all these mea culpas now in the press. Oh, my God, how did we give so much airtime to Trump, and we fed this monster? And NBC itself, I saw an analysis. They have devoted 288 minutes of coverage throughout the summer through Labor Day to Trump, compared with 93 to Hillary Clinton. So there's a lot of scrambling to make up for the fact that, in fact, yes, we have this this guy who drives
makes
ratings
money.
And,
right.
and right brings right. in ads and yeah. that's why he's a candidate.
Thanks, Ruth, so much for being with us. Look forward to our next talk. Who knows what will happen next? Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Progressive Magazine. Thanks to Scotty Myers and Chris Molina for producing the show. KP Whaley for on-air production here in Milwaukee. News coming up, and then we'll look at presidential campaigns through history.